Hi, Amanda.
Welcome back.
Thanks. Welcome back for the very last time.
To the Hopeless Romantic. As always, I am your host, Austin Chant.
I am your other host, Amanda Jean.
I love this new styling we've got. Let's just do the whole podcast this way. This is really riveting audio content.
It's a little Shatnerian is maybe the word.
Is that pertaining to William Shatner?
Yeah, who's still dead to me and will always be dead to me now. How dare he? I didn't know that that was what the episode was going
to
turn into.
This is a good launch to the final episode of our queer romance podcast.
Call this episode William Shatner is dead to me. He is, though. He took 7 red pills. I don't know what happened. He was always a little weird because he's William Shatner, but I stand him for so long, and now I'm like, please just don't. Oh, did I ever tell THR that he blocked me on Twitter years ago?
I don't think you have.
Oh my god. I can't believe I kept this from you all. I'm so sorry. So, years ago, he was live blogging, live tweeting some fucking ungodly CW show. I don't remember what it was, but it was bad. And he just wouldn't stop. Like, he just hashtagged it and would just tweet incessantly. And I thought to myself, and then tweeted the following verbatim, it's a good thing that William Shatner is William Shatner and therefore untouchable because he tweets incessantly. And William Shatner is not good at joking criticism. Or criticism at all, really, because he blocked me, and I don't think he understood at the time that that was a blow directly to my heart, and now I'm like, good. It's a point of pride. At the time, I was like, how do I get him to unblock me? Should I go to, like, Emerald City Comic Con and tell him that I own his shitty movie in Esperanto? Should I tell him, like, everything I know about his life? Should I do that? Is that a good way to get someone to unblock you on Twitter, telling them creepy details you've gleaned about their existence and you don't know them?
This is actually a really great example of what we've talked about a lot recently of how not to engage with creators and how to maintain appropriate boundaries.
See, I did maintain the boundaries by not doing that because I realized it was the actions of someone desperate and unrestrained, but I did think about it.
That's fair.
Also, fuck him. You know what? At this point, in terms of old men who I have affinities for in my warm heart, if Sir Anthony fucking Hopkins ever lets me down, I quit life. Like, I just give up the end. I'm done. Stick a fork in me. I can't do this anymore.
Yeah. I hope Sir Anthony. He seems like a chill dude. I hope he's a
chill
dude. He
seems so nice. He makes his art. He makes his music. He's such a weird old dude who likes to make movies and drive. And he's Welsh. Well, he's American now. He has citizenship, but he is Welsh.
Again, Amanda, with the details about people's lives.
I collect them. That wasn't even intentional. I just learn stuff and don't forget it. Mm-hmm. I can't remember how to do complex math, but I can remember that Anthony Hopkins became an American citizen.
Sure. So we've now spent a lot more time than I expected to talking about William Shatner and Anthony Hopkins. This is the last episode of our podcast about queer romance.
It's ostensibly about queer romance. One of the reasons we decided to retire THR was because we were starting to come to a point of talking about queer romance where we were just having to reinvent the wheel. Not that there isn't a glut and a breadth of interesting fiction to talk about. It's just like, do we do another post on how people should not be shitty? Should we do another episode on how to not be racist? So I feel like this wildly off topic beginning is indicative of why we're relaunching our podcasting career.
That's also just an indication of the kind of people we are.
Quitters?
How dare you? I was going to say people who ramble incessantly.
Okay, that's fair. This is our 40th episode. Our finale is episode 40. So I feel like over the previous 40 episodes and 2.5 years, a little over, now that the end is near and we're facing the final curtain, mm-hmm. My friend, I'll say it clear.
Okay.
I'll state my case of which I am certain.
Can I keep going?
Yes. I'm not done. I haven't gotten to the important line.
Uh-huh.
So I've lived a life that's full, and I have actually traveled each and every highway, I think. But more, much more than this, I did it my way. And I have had a few regrets. I should finish with that. I was actually going to sing
good
it.
Audio. Wow, that looks really good.
Your seal clapping just showed up great in Audacity. Mm-hmm.
Looks amazing.
I'm sad that I didn't sing it, but I'm forgetting the tune mm-hmm. when I was thinking about it earlier. And I was like, you don't want to do Frank dirty like that. So don't. So in this finale, I wanted to first talk a little bit about just some random THR reminiscence and trivia. And then we'll get into our usual stuff, because both Austin and myself have a lot to scream and pound tables about re-media we recently consumed. Austin earlier today. Some interesting stuff about THR. I'm sure everybody knows that this was conceived in the living room of the apartment that Austin and I used to share, because we were sitting around yelling about something and realized that we both really like to talk and hear ourselves talk.
It's true.
And the things we were saying were semi-important. And we were like, what if someone else would listen to us? And we figured at that point that it would just be Daria, and maybe a few of our friends would pity us.
Yeah.
But at the same time, we also had delusions of grandeur.
Just enough to carry us through a few initial episodes and discover that some people really did want to hear us talk.
Yeah, and that podcasting is both a lot of fun and logistically difficult in ways we had not expected. I really have loved trying so many weird things on this show and talking to so many fucking awesome people that I would never have thought I would hear the voices of.
Yeah, I was gonna say, I am looking back just in awe of how many amazing guests we had and how many people were willing to respond to usually Amanda being like, hey, do you want to talk to us on our show for innumerable hours?
Yeah,
in
sometimes
some cases,
three.
Many. Looking at you, CS Picat. Thanks.
Thanks,
we
CS.
Love you.
Thanks, Cat. Actually, that's one of my notes of trivia. The Cat Picat episode is our most popular. Not like a huge margin, by a pretty substantial margin. And it's like a year and a half old, so it certainly had some time to get that long tail of listens. Kind of still am not over the fact that this weird podcast let me interview Jim Grimsley.
Yeah. That was so rad.
That was so weird. Also, a note of trivia that I can now disclose because it's over and who cares, but Christopher Rice initially agreed to be on THR, and I thought he would be an interesting guest, but I also had not. This is the sequence of events. Me. Ooh, we could interview Christopher Rice. Austin. Okay. Me. Emails Christopher Rice. Hi, you want to be on our podcast? Christopher Rice. Sure. Me. Sends him some details. Christopher Rice doesn't respond. And then I realized that we had recently released an episode wherein I had talked a lot of shit about Anne Rice. Like, not just a little, a lot. I had said some things and gone some places. And it may have been coincidence that Christopher Rice dropped off the face of planet Earth read the emails. And it's possible that if I emailed him today, he would be like, oh yeah, I forgot about that. But I also think it's entirely likely that he listened to me shit talk his mother and was like, maybe I shouldn't go on this podcast.
And then we've all learned a valuable lesson.
Don't invite Christopher Rice onto your podcast if you're going to talk shit about his mother.
I think that's the exact lesson.
It's such a specific one.
Yeah.
I will carry it to my grave.
I'm sure it will continue to be relevant throughout our lives. Yeah, I just want to say a big old thank you to everybody who's been on the show in the last couple years, because we have had so many good conversations. We've had so many interesting people come on and educate us on so many cool things and help us share so much knowledge in the industry with our listenership. And we really could not have done it without so many people being so generous with their time. It's been an awesome run, and I'm excited to not stop doing it.
Yeah, we're not gonna... We're just shifting gears. I will say, I had a two-parter or maybe even a three-parter planned that was going to be about writing a series, and it was going to feature interviews with a bunch of THR guests, some previous and some new ones. And if you are one of those people who is listening to this right now, I actually still want to talk to you on the Red Pen. So I'm already starting to send out my little tentacle feelers, like, hey, you want to talk to us on our new podcast? But we're not going to have a ton of guests like we did before. In fact, they'll probably be relegated to segments. But I still like the idea of talking because, you know, there's only with the Red Pen, there's only so many things that I can manufacture like in-depth analyzation of. And it may be something that I want to talk about, but don't have quite the right frame for. So I've got some people where I'm like, they're going to say some really smart shit about stuff that I like. So we're going to have them on.
I'm so excited. We'll probably talk more about the Red Pen later in the episode, but I think it's going to be an awesome new venture. And I really appreciate the words of support from folks who have checked in after we announced that we were ending THR.
Yeah, everyone's been so nice.
And I really appreciate the folks who said they're sticking with us. It's super awesome. And thank you for being here and listening to us talk
so much
all this time.
If you add up the hours of THR, every episode was pretty much over an hour. There were some that got close to two. So I think they've comfortably listened to about 45 to 50 hours of us.
Yeah.
If you've listened to every episode. That's a lot.
Wow. Good job, guys.
Yeah. That's incredible. And I would like to point out that not only did Austin and myself say those hours of content and then cut more of it, I had to listen to it multiple times. So if you find me annoying, you're not alone. I also find me very annoying.
I don't that's find not, Amanda annoying.
That's only partially true. I find myself annoying due to certain quirks and traits that I'm trying to eliminate. So I just know things that my voice does. I want to put a sock in my mouth, which would really impact audio quality. But
yeah, that would be good. I would love to just do our socks in mouth podcast.
That'd be a fucking delight. So I wanted to mention a couple other little THR trivia things before we moved on. Our second most popular country, obviously first is the US because we are a very Western focused podcast, but our second most popular country is Japan by like a wide margin, like about 10% of our listeners are from Japan. And I looked it up and specifically a huge chunk of them are in Tokyo. So if you're listening to us and you are in Japan and you are maybe even in Tokyo, hello! Thank you.
Thanks
that's
for
incredible.
Listening. That's awesome.
Yeah, that's so cool. The most popular listening method is Apple Podcasts, which is what I also use to listen to stuff. But we were recently added to Spotify, so we've gotten a chunk of Spotify listeners. And a lot of people listen to on the website, which is also very sweet. Someone was listening via VLC Media Player, which is the media player I use, but I was like, what? Okay, that's
sure.
Cool. I love VLC. I support them. If you don't know what VLC is, it's a media player that's fucking awesome and can play basically any format, and it's just great and it's beautiful and I love it.
Yeah, that's
it.
Old
works.
School. That's the program I would download back in the day to watch all of my pirated content in one convenient player.
Yeah, because it plays like everything.
Not that I've ever watched pirated content.
Never in my whole life. I've never pirated anything.
No, nobody ever has.
I don't now, but there was certainly a period of my life where I was just like, yo-ho, yo-ho. Yeah, VLC. Also, every Christmas, they change their little icon, like the little VLC icon, which looks like an orange traffic cone, and they put a Santa hat on it.
Aww.
For Christmas. I know, I love VLC. Anyway, cool that you listened to a podcast via VLC. And then I think that's pretty much it. It was just interesting to see our most popular episodes are not super surprising. Obviously, C.S. Paquette and K.J. Charles were up there as well as our pilot. But again, y'all really liked Beef Man.
Super into Beef Man.
Love and
I think that's just something y'all need to sort of negotiate with yourselves. You need to figure out what's going on there.
Mess.
Because I have no sort of explanation for that.
There's no explanation. No, I listened to it again recently when I found out that it was the most, like, fourth most popular episode, and I was like, fucking Beef Man?
Every so often I think about how drunk we were that day, and I just feel bad. I feel bad for putting that energy into the world.
Yeah, it was real chaotic.
Never do that.
The year previous, we had had our first drunk episode, and I think that one was a delight. Like, that one was understandable. It had a narrative. And then the Beef Man was just yelling. Like, it was just bizarre. I'm very appreciative of the love for Beef Man, but I do have many questions. And then people really liked our Call Me By Your Name episode. We got a lot of, I assume, one-off listens for that, probably because of SEO stuff, but that was cool. I don't know, it's just really interesting to see what is popular. Like, one of our Hopeless After Dark episodes was really popular, but the other one wasn't. And I was like, what did I do in the keywords? Did I put, like, fisting in the keywords? And it...
And everybody was like, fisting.
This is what I want.
That is how, by the way, that's a podcasting hot tip. If you want people to listen to your content, just tag whatever it is, fisting. Automatic 1,000 listens that way.
I'm going to put Dorian Gray fisting.
Please. In this.
That's a great segue, Amanda. Holy shit. Austin.
Yeah.
Tell me about what you did today.
So I went to a live staging of A Picture of Dorian Gray today. It's at a theater in Seattle called Book It.
That's cute.
Which, yeah, their whole thing is that they take books and they make stage versions of them where part of it is narrated by the ensemble cast. Some of it's even narrated by the actors who are playing the characters, like still in character, but in third person, interspersed with dialogue, which is a really interesting way of portraying it. It means you get a lot more of the actual prose and a lot of the author's voice in it. I thought it was really interesting, and it was still really immersive, even though it was kind of fourth wall breaking. They managed to make the atmosphere of the space itself so like overwhelming that it's still just all, it kept you sucked into the space. I had a lot of feelings about it. As probably most folks know, I'm really into The Picture of Dorian Gray. I own now, I think, 7 or maybe 8 copies of it.
You have more copies of that than you do Peter Pan.
Yeah, I only have 1 copy of Peter Pan.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah.
Who are you?
I have Peter Pan and then assorted related to Peter Pan books.
Yeah, that's
but
true.
Only the 1 copy of the book itself. I'm just really kind of fixated on it. I think it's not even necessarily my favorite book, although I do love Oscar Wilde's prose, but just what it represents. The fact that it was so much of what got Oscar Wilde imprisoned for obscenity. The fact that it is a very queer book written by a queer man that is so... It perfectly sits in that place between condemning something and also endorsing it. It's at the same time a moral story and also an amoral story, and something that is about giving in to, you know, who you want to be and what you want to do, but that also associates that with a lot of evil. I think it's really, really interesting, and I've read it a whole bunch and I really enjoyed it, and this play brought it to life for me in a way that it has never been before. It just all of a sudden hit me in a really big way, all that this story represents. I'm still trying to kind of wrap my words around why that was. It's like Oscar Wilde's prose is really kind of flippant. He's very funny and he's very distanced. I mean, the whole book is told in like this very distant, florid, omnipotent POV that is floating around the characters, kind of judging them. It's very witty. It's very wry.
A lot of wicked little asides.
Yeah, it's full of, you know, Lord Henry just lounging on a couch, like, making snide remarks about all of society. So there's all this, you know, social commentary.
It's very meta.
Yeah, and that was always kind of the spirit in which I had read the book. But this staging brought the characters to life in a way that revealed all of the human emotion behind that. Because you still have these characters, especially the Lord Henry, who was amazing, who are being very flippant and very dry, but you also see them as people. The amount of emotion that he brought to the role, kind of behind this character who is being very dry and very flippant, it brought out all of the queerness of the text. In a very overt way, it makes it very clear that the three men are very much in various ways in love with each other. Layering that like very intense, emotionally sincere queer subtext and kind of despair and products of the times, like underneath all of this flippancy, it was like gut-wrenching. At the same time that it was still very funny, because you could see all of the coping with the circumstances that is ingrained in that type of humor, like using it as a way to grapple with a very fucked up reality and a very fucked up time for queer folks. The way that Lord Henry was portrayed is as somebody who is fundamentally very unhappy and is just deflecting and deflecting and deflecting. But you get these moments of just absolute sincerity from him where he like sees Dorian for the first time and is totally struck, and Dorian walks into the room for the first time and meets Lord Henry, and both of them just fall completely silent while the narration is happening, and they're just like staring each other's eyes. And it was so intense. Then Lord Henry goes right back to being like flippant and shitty.
But you've seen that crack in the armor.
You've seen that crack, and you see that behaving like this is the only way any of them know how to be. Ugh.
That's painful. You were talking about the actual staging, like the way that the stage was constructed, I think.
Yes, the staging was really cool. So Book It is a tiny theater. I really highly recommend it for anybody who's in the Seattle area. This was unfortunately the last showing picture of Dorian Gray, but I'm sure their other work is rad. So it's a tiny theater and kind of a low ceiling, very, very intimate. If you're in the front row, you're 5 to 10 feet away from the actors, and on the same level. It's very dark, and they kept it very dark for most of the show and had very simple staging, you know, not a lot of props, not a lot of setting. And then the details would just pop out because they had... they would shine in like one light, and it would be a really warm like sunlight beam, and they filled the room with smoke, so you would just have this like beam of sunlight coming in through dust and smoke. It would feel so much like you're, you know, watching it in this dark attic, which is where he hides the portrait. So it just sort of got increasingly enclosed as Dorian kind of breaks down, and it just gets darker and darker, and the beams of sunlight just sort of serve to highlight how dark it is at that point, which is a great metaphor for the use of humor to indicate how grim something is. Anyway.
I don't relate to that at all.
Yeah. And the guy who played Dorian was like extremely beautiful, and they did an amazing job of aging the other characters with, you know, costuming and makeup, while just increasingly like increasing his glow and like his blush and radiance. They would have, you know, him alone be captured by this one beam of light while everybody else is in shadow, everybody else is aging and decaying while he stays fresh as a daisy. And then they would also use it to pick out like the actual frame of the portrait as like bright gold, and so they would shine this light in and it would be like all you could see is just like the borders of the portrait around him. It was so cool. Anyway, it gave me a lot of feeling. It's so cool to have a piece of literature that you've, you know, read so much and read so much about and enjoyed in so many ways, and then to just have it like take on a whole new dimension like that. It was awesome. And it also just made me really sad. Because I sat there thinking about Oscar Wilde for a long time and being like, man, fuck this.
Oscar being so traumatized, I mean, he shouldn't have been in prison in the first place, obviously, but so brokenhearted, traumatized, physically injured in jail, and then like coming out of it and dying pretty shortly after, a year or two?
It was very shortly after he...
I mean, I'm glad he got out. It would be worse if he died in prison, but it's just the idea of this man who was maligned and punished and ostracized for, first embraced for all of his quirks and all of his sort of queerness in all sense of the word, and then ultimately completely punished and destroyed for it. It's just such a tragic story of a genius, basically. And it makes me sad every time I think about it. And then it makes me sad whenever I read his fucking letter to Bosie, De Profundis, which I think I have the unedited version, or the most unedited version that they have released to date. Because, boy, Oscar's children got their hands on that and did not release it in its entirety, I believe. And also, I think Bosie's estate had something to do with it.
I'm very sad. The subtext of all this is that I'm very sad. I think it did such a good job of highlighting like all of the ways that you can say something without saying it, but also the impact of not being able to say, you know, the truth of who you are and what you love. Because it really dances around queerness in the ways that it would have to.
Everything was subtext. Not only in the play, but in Oscar's life and the lives of a lot of queer people, especially those who were in any sort of public eye. I'm sure it spread everywhere, but if you were someone like Oscar, like there was only so much you'd get away with.
It got me thinking a lot about queer romance and the role of queer romance and why this genre is so important, which I wanted to kind of come back to and reflect on as we are about to step away from queer romance as a focus. We're not leaving it, but we won't be exclusively working on and around queer romance.
We'll always be that lens, yeah.
That even even growing up, I never really imagined a genre that could be so straightforward about what it is, and so willing to just name exactly who the people are in it and what it is about and who it is for. All of that is so new. The ability to just say, this is a gay romance book for gays. Like, and have it be just so clear cut and straightforward. And like, this is just like a happy book about two women who love each other. Ta-da! The end. I know we've talked a lot about why romance is important versus other genres. Well, not versus other genres, but like why romance has a place that it will always have in the fulfillment of the happy ending and why that's so important. But really just hit that home for me all over again, I think, of how important this development in literature is and how important that we keep pushing forward with that. Because you look back on something like The Picture of Dorian Gray and you have it brought to life for you as a story about men in love who just are dancing around each other, and one of them becomes a fucking murderer, and one of them is murdered, and the last of them is flippant and sad and old and lonely. That story was considered poison at the time and obscenity, even though it portrays not happy gay people, like, in any sense of the word.
And very subtextual gay people, like, obviously, since it was considered obscene, and it was considered pretty heavily queer-coded, there was objection to that, but there was still wiggle room for others to say, well, no, it isn't queer, it's just a sort of morality, it's a basic morality tale.
Yeah. Yeah, that was actually one of the other really cool things about this staging, is they based their staging on the original manuscript, not the edited version that came out later. It was like the original, much more concise version, where when it was released as a novel, there are three versions of Picture of Dorian Gray. The first was released in a magazine. It was heavily censored by Oscar Wilde's editor without Oscar Wilde's knowledge. The second version was published as a novel. It was revised and expanded, still censored. It introduced more elements of morality. It introduced, like, a villain, all this stuff. And then the original version, which was found later and wasn't published until 2011.
Oh, I haven't read that.
Yeah, I know. Neither have I. That's why I bought another copy of the book today.
Shit. I need that, like, now.
Yeah. They based it on that. So it doesn't have, there's like a dude who tries to murder Dorian or something. It cuts so much of that out. It's really just about Dorian and Basil and Lord Henry, a couple of, you know, Sybil and the extended cast. It was so interesting to just have that focus in, cut out all kind of the extraneous elements that he was made to add and that made it a little more palatable and a little bit more of a morality tale. It was just super good.
I'm sad I didn't see this sad gay agony with you. I'm that is so my jam. You know, I share your Oscar Wilde feeling. You know what's funny is I was thinking back to, I think this is, I'm sure there's been wonderful stage plays of Dorian Gray before, but all I can think about is that fucking god-awful movie they made with Colin Firth and Ben Barnes, where their nod to queerness, aside from the inescapable queer subtext in it, their nod to queerness was, like, I believe a shot of an orgy scene where there were dudes also in the pile with Dorian. It's been a long time since I've seen it. And I think they may have even cut that. Like, I really don't think it was very queer at all. God, that movie was a fucking abomination. No offense to Colin Firth and Ben Barnes, but it was not fucking good. I think it's one of those things that you either have to do a very strict Merchant and Ivory style adaptation of it, or you have to go somewhat surrealist. You also have to be unrepentantly queer about it, because that, I just don't think it works if it's too censored.
It is a fucking embarrassment and a disgrace to the name of Oscar Wilde if you try to make The Picture of Dorian Gray not queer.
And it's just not a good story without that aspect. Like, it's just about three shitty people otherwise.
Yeah, it loses the heart completely.
Yeah, it loses the motive for a lot of it. You can write on paper, oh, he wants to stay young and beautiful forever.
Also, I have a huge complaint about, I think, every adaptation I have ever seen other than this one of Dorian Gray, which is that people cannot get away from trying to do some kind of like evil visual cue for Dorian. They cannot get away from being like, ooh, he's kind of Dracula. Creepy. Yeah, he's got like, he's kind of hollow looking, or like, he's got greasy hair. And it's just like, the entire point of the picture of Dorian Gray is that he is beautiful in a very like classic cherubic, like innocent little angel boy way. And he's fucking despicable. That's the entire point of it.
So if you make him like, I was going to say tall, dark, and handsome, but usually tall, fair, gaunt, and dark-haired. It doesn't really, like, it just doesn't work. I think that's more of our sort of modern aesthetic. Oh, he's a bad boy. Beautiful bad boy. And it's like, no, you're really left of center here. He's supposed to be staggeringly beautiful. Like you said, like cherubic. Like he's it's supposed to be a classical...
Specifically, he is supposed to appeal to people's ideas of what an innocent little boy looks like so much that they can't believe that he is capable of sin, basically.
You know, there's almost a muted desire there because it's so cherubic. Like, it's so
wholesome.
He's supposed
to be very, like, pure. And it, not that that is actually what purity is, but, like, he is supposed to represent, like, he's supposed to be the exact epitome of what that visually looks like and be like this pure, untainted, beautiful youth. That's the point. That's the whole point.
If he doesn't look, if in your adaptation he doesn't look at home holding a harp and smiling beatifically, you fucked up.
It's so annoying to me. I've never been so annoyed as every time I see a picture of Dorian Gray where they're trying to make him look edgy. And I'm like...
Like he skulks.
You don't get it.
So it's no offense to like various actors who have portrayed him, because they're all pretty much everyone I've ever seen. Like they cast someone good looking on purpose, but they are definitely going for an overall aesthetic that just doesn't gel with the intention, and it doesn't like it just doesn't add up with this idea of this character who is secretly gross being visually like above reproach and beautiful. And if you have a dude who looks like he skulks in the shadows and smirks at you, it just doesn't work.
It doesn't make sense. Yeah, and that was the, again, the amazing thing about the staging is the dude that they cast is just like, he is so beautiful. And they had him, you know, perfectly maintain like his all of his facial expressions. Even as this character is like on a downward spiral, they have him maintain that outward beguiling and disarming innocence in his face. Again, I just can't stress this enough. That's the whole point.
Yep.
Is that it's an illusion.
If there's a level of self-awareness, like it just doesn't work if he's winking. It just doesn't work.
It's such an annoying, catastrophically bad reading of the text to do that. And it's such an annoying reliance on like, we need to make someone look bad. So we're going to do all of these things. Surely we can't just have somebody who is like an angelic cherubic boy actually be evil.
We have to see visual cues because it's so people annoying. Are foolish.
It's so annoying. That's my TED talk.
mic drop on your way out. Just like, boom.
I think it really got to me. I know. Sorry. This is TED Talk 2. I'm climbing back on the soapbox.
Soapboxes.
I'm up on it. I'm ready. I think it got to me because, as we kind of discussed in a previous podcast, the discourse has really gotten to me this month, this Pride Month. We're recording this on July 1st, so Pride Month has just ended. The amount of navel-gazing and community infighting in the discourse this month has been atrocious. It has made me very sad about the state of our activism as a community. And boy, this is a heavy soapbox. Boy.
Stand on it. Stand firm.
I'm standing firm. It has just really stung to see how much we turn on each other and how poorly focused we are on uplifting each other. To be thrown back to the 1890s of queerdom and see the silence and the suffering imposed there, and then to jump forward to the generation of my dearest mentors of the 80s and 90s and the 70s, and of the AIDS crisis, and see how much our community has had to overcome and fight for together. I just can't stand petty infighting anymore. there's no reason we should be doing this. There's no reason we should not be giving each other the benefit of the doubt and treating each other with respect and uplifting each other and finding ways to be inclusive and respectful, united, to face all of the shit outside, because we are incredibly lucky right now to be living in an era where we can connect online, make contact with each other, and build bridges and build coalition. And yet, so much I see us using that platform to shit on each other. And that sucks. It really, really sucks. Not how we should be wielding the incredible privilege that we have to organize in this way.
It's also right now, especially, I'm not going to kid myself by saying that things have been wonderful in the last, you know, let's say 8 years, and especially for folks with different levels of privilege, like a lot of us have been blind to just how bad things are in the West. But I feel like if we're at this boiling point within the world, within the queer community itself, like we're still having to grip tightly onto rights and still having to do activism that is so desperate and badly needed, that we're taking time aside from that to like snipe at each other on Twitter about who's the better queer. I don't have like, and obviously, again, your key word there was petty. Like, obviously I'm still going to be mad at TERFs or whatever, but I just have no time. Like, the shit is on fire. We need to stop yelling at each other. And I think that's a huge trick of what the oppressive class does to the oppressed, is like makes you turn on each other. It makes you squabble amongst yourselves. It's a brilliant deflection tactic that I think most of us think we're above, but we still fall victim to it because it's like we don't have the power and access to people sort of stomping down on us. So it's like we have to police everybody else in our midst. No, there's still a boot crushing down. We need to take care of the boot. Then we can argue about like who's the most woke or whatever. Unless you are doing active harm to me or people who are more vulnerable than me, I really need to have everybody like link arms and protect each other and uplift each other, because this is bad and it's going to get worse if we keep yelling at each other while the world burns.
I could not agree more. Like, we do have to walk that line of there can be intercommunity harm that is genuine, and that still needs to be addressed. But I am so over throwing away the allies that we have, both intercommunity and externally. Like, if I were to dump every person I had ever had to explain something to, or who said something screwed up, or who didn't know better, or like, you know, needed time to come to righteousness or whatever, I would have no one. And I think that is true for everyone, because we have to give each other a little more leeway and a little more benefit of the doubt. And I think this is maybe my last point on this soapbox, but I was talking to a friend the other day about how in this era, we have a lot, trolling is a problem. Let's put it that way. Trolling is not only a problem, it's tied to a lot of white supremacist groups and Nazis and, you know, all that jazz. Like, we have a lot of trolls in the ecosystem. We have a lot of people operating in bad faith in online discussions. But I think we've reached a point where we treat everybody as if they are operating in bad faith.
And we can't tell the difference between when somebody's legitimately in bad faith trying to stir the pot and like start something and make you believe that it's real versus somebody who says something kind of fucked up one time. There's a difference between somebody in your community fucking up versus somebody coming in to destroy it.
I think, like, yes, there are cases of like 4chan attempting to infiltrate. This happened the other day, attempting to infiltrate to spread Discord by saying shitty things about bi people. And that happens, but I think more often than not, it's not that hard to tell when people are operating in bad faith versus maybe they're asking a question you don't want to answer right now. But maybe that doesn't mean they're the devil.
Anyway, I have a lot of feelings about how I feel like people coming to disturb, to wreak havoc, to stir up chaos is usually so fucking transparent.
And not only that, but like, we can't treat everybody like they're operating as an interloper who needs to be destroyed. We just can't. You can't build a community that way. You have to generally give people the benefit of the doubt, kick out the people who are genuinely operating in bad faith. Like, you can't just operate with your spikes out 100% of the time. And I see so much of that, that I'm done.
It's so funny because that's not how it works in my experience, in my like real life, well, not real life, in my flesh plane, queer communities.
No.
That's not how it works. That's not how people treat each other. That's not how we meet each other. And when there is someone who comes into a group that may be harmful, most of us operate in a way that shuts them out, cuts them out, confronts them, and doesn't, there's nothing performative about it. There's nothing, like, we assume that somebody who comes into our space is in good faith, and we treat them like human beings. And if we find out that they are not in good faith, if we find out they're abusive, if we find out something about them is just not compatible with us, we cut them out. It's not a constant, like, headlock with people we meet to sort of prove that we're the better queer person, or that we're, you know, we have more points or whatever. Like, I can't imagine having to run my social circle like that. That's not how any of us act. We're all really friendly and weird. And if somebody is introduced or sort of steps into our circle, we're very welcoming. So the idea that, you know, the things that especially younger people are learning, if especially, like, let's say they live somewhere where they don't have a broader queer community, their only exposure to it is online. The rules of engagement they're taught for how you treat your fellow queer people is, like, interrogate them, be better than them, distrust them, be suspicious of them. While some of that is survival techniques to protect yourself against potential abusers, or, you know, you should be, if you aren't familiar with a lot of queer people, it may be hard to find your place, but no one's going to like the person who constantly shames, interrogates, and screams at their fellow queers. It's just not, you're not going to make friends that way. You're not going to have a community that way. You'll be shut out as a toxic element. So I'm a little worried for people who are coming up in circumstances where this is their grand introduction to how queer communities function, because it's fucking not. This is not even, I mean, there can be toxic dynamics everywhere and there are abusers in many places lurking, but that's not how it works in even some of the most militant activist circles that I've been exposed to. There's still a sense of community and not just tearing everybody down.
I think the thing that disappoints me the most is that I feel like it has shut down good conversations as well. It's made them very hard to have because, you know, in the last couple months that I can think of, I've seen things come across my dash from fellow queer folks that I'm like, I disagree with that. But not in a way where I want to, like, fight you. I don't want to fight you. I would love to actually have a discussion about this, because maybe there's a portion of your experience that I'm not getting. Maybe I could share my perspective. Maybe there's a common ground here. But that is not a conversation that we have. That is not a dynamic that we're enacting where we can actually work together to build something.
There's no nuance.
Yeah, because there can't be any nuance. Because the only reason I would engage with someone in that way is presumed to be so I would shame them for their view for being wrong.
Or agree with them.
And put them on, or agree with them. You can't build community around the idea that you only either agree with someone and they're your ally, or you disagree with them and they're the enemy. Like, you can't.
There are very few places where I draw that line. Because, you know, obviously we discussed this, like, a TERF, a white supremacist, something like that. Like, I am comfortable being like, oh, nope, you disagree with me about that? You're my enemy. But the smaller, like, the less, you know, racist and fucking gender essentialist shit, there's nuance there. Not everybody's experience is the same. Like, we talked about in a previous episode, in the problematic gay shit episode, about how you can't police other people's experiences of media. You also can't police other people's experiences of life. You can tell them your own perspective. You can give them advice. You could tell them where there may be some problematic elements in their thinking. God, I hate that word now. Please strike it. But you can't. Yelling at them, screaming at them is not... One, it's not going to gain you any sense of community or enrich your life in any way. But it's also not going to change anybody's mind. Because all you've done is yelled. Yeah, cheerful episode.
Welcome to the THR finale.
Got some everything that's wrong. Do you want me to talk about? Oh, are you?
I do. I think I want to end this on a hopeful note, which is that I am trying to be the media presence that I want to see in the world. And I encourage other people to do the same. If you too are fed up of this stuff and just stop rewarding the kind of behavior that is, you know, quote tweeting people in the community to yell at them, or quarreling over semantics in ways that don't create room for nuance and valuable conversations, and start rewarding valuable conversations that you see, and try engaging yourself in ways that open up the possibilities that other people's experiences could be valid and that they could have reasonable things to say, even if you disagree with them.
And also you were wrong and shitty once too, probably.
Yes, also
I was so wrong and so shitty for so much of my life.
Extremely wrong and shitty.
I'm still wrong and shitty. I'm just less wrong and shitty than I was. Like, I've improved 0.5%. Ooh, saint me. Make a sculpture of me.
Because I think this is important. I'm going to throw out an example from my own life that embarrassed me deeply when I rediscovered it the other day. I don't even remember how I came across this. I think I was checking my very oldest email, which...
Don't do that. Never do that. It's bad. Don't do that.
There was a lot in there to not like. But one of the things that was the absolute worst to me was I found it's probably on LiveJournal comment thread where I'd been like, at the time, super cisplaining something to trans folks on a community. I was like 12 at the time and also had not come out as trans yet, but I still looked back and I was like, oh my God.
I am the worst. I was the
like,
worst.
I was this person. Like, it wasn't anything, like, I wasn't being virulently transphobic or anything.
You were just very earnestly cisplaining at the time.
Yeah, I was super, it was condescending and like, it was not all cissing and just obnoxious. You know what? We're all there at some point or other. Even if you don't think you are, and you can't make yourself not that way by closing yourself off to criticism and conversation. In fact, that I think is the greatest guarantee that you will be that person. At some point, you're gonna double down on something you shouldn't if you do that. And the only way to protect yourself is to actually be open to nuance and conversation and valuing other people's perspectives. That's my TED Talk.
We have to struggle every day with the sort of societally ingrained things that we were taught and picked up by osmosis. Our own fucking privilege, the weird shit that our community, our parents, our teachers gave us, and our own sense of self and how willing we are to like look at our character flaws and look at these deep-seated ideas that maybe we didn't realize were a little like racist or whatever. It's hard, yeah. If I look back at stuff when I thought I was pretty good. I thought I was all right. I don't think I was going around being like, I am the pinnacle of morality and I am the most woke. But I was certainly not working very hard to challenge my existing ideas. And it was ugly. Like, it was just ugly. I remember being told by somebody not to use a particular slur, and I just had a knee-jerk reaction that I didn't want to stop. And I remember just not understanding how I could use a different pronoun for someone I had already known by a different pronoun. Just this stuff where I just had deep primal responses where my whole being just went, no, I don't want to do that. And if you don't stop having these things where you're like, I'm going to write a 4-paragraph essay on Tumblr about my personal feelings to someone else being called out. That happened. All the discourse. I'm taking this personally because you're attacking me with your ideas. Yeah. You're kind of always garbage and you just have to keep reducing the ratio. You just got to keep shrinking it down, working, finding new places to clean.
And you can't, I will die on this hill. You can't do that by yelling at people on Twitter, even if they're wrong.
Yeah. Anyway, on that note, I want to talk about two good things. Good things. Good.
Amanda, take us to a happier place.
I'll take us to a place I did not put in the notes. Also, my roommate is legitimately, whatever the fuck she made, I would literally rip it out of her hands and eat it right now. It smells so fucking good. So, one of the reasons why this episode was delayed was because I did some traveling in June and Austin did some stuff that precluded our recording times matching up. And I traveled to San Francisco with my BFF Macy, who y'all have probably heard a lot about, and we went and saw the McElroys do two shows at the Warfield. One was My Brother and Me, and the other one was The Adventure Zone. And this was a moment, like, a lot of my McElroy content consumption has been self-care. Honestly, it's been very personal, even though I've shared some of it on THR, and even though I talk about it with Austin and our friends, it's been extremely personal. I think it honestly got me through the latter half of 2017 and the beginning of 2018. Like, I think that this was one of those things where I was like, aha, I have something to live for. I have something that just makes me happy or makes me feel things that I'm not getting from other avenues. So it was a really freaky experience to go to San Francisco and see these thousands of other people who probably have a similar emotional reaction. Like, they were so happy to be there. They were so, like, so many people were in cosplay. So many people brought their parents. I was standing behind this two parents and, like, I assume teenager or maybe even early 20s person. And the dad turned around, looked at the line and said, I didn't realize they were popular enough to have, like, all of these people. And I was thinking to myself, I knew that they were. I knew that they have hundreds of thousands of listeners on their various podcasts and that this is not something that was just created for my ears only. But it was the sort of media that felt like it was made for me, that felt like it touched something so personal that it could only have, you know, been a private small thing. But it was such a good moment of connection to sit among these thousands of strangers who are all screaming with joy for the same thing that I am. And to be there with my best friend, who I dragged kicking and screaming into this as well. Sorry, Macy. You're welcome. It was a weird life-affirming moment, and I feel strange in its aftermath. It was so good and pure, and everybody there was just so funny and happy. And I wish that more of my life was like that. And that was a moment where I was like, okay, I got to find more things that make me feel like that. I have to find ways to feel connected to other people I don't know as well. Like, obviously I know my circle of friends quite well, but we're also there for the bad shit. We're also there for the depressive episodes and the trauma. So I want to just be in a room full of people who are all screaming with joy more than I am now.
Yeah.
I know how miserable I've been over the past chunk of time. I'm aware. I'm keeping my finger on the pulse of my own, you know, mental health, but
we all know how fucked up we are right now.
We were aware. But when I was sitting there, I had that moment of, oh, it doesn't always have to be like this. There are still things that make you happy and other people can be happy too. And that if I live in that mindset, like I'm constantly under siege, which, you know, I kind of am. What's the point if I don't occasionally have a moment in a room with a bunch of strangers that feels transcendent and joyful? Why am I bothering to do this at all?
Yeah. Yeah, I actually had, while we're just sharing nice experiences to make up for the earlier part of this show, I had a really good time at Pride this year. I wound up in a bar where the vibe was just joyful and so friendly. And I just, even though it was so loud in there, everyone was just sort of screaming. Like,
my favorite part of bars.
I still wound up just striking up random conversations with a bunch of people, scream conversations about stuff we liked. It wasn't even particularly like, ooh, I'm flirting with strangers. It was more like they saw my Jurassic Park shirt and were like, oh, I love Jurassic Park. Have you seen the second movie? Have you read the book, though? It's really good.
The book is very good. I'm glad these strangers knew.
They knew. And I ran into a guy who had a pin from the original release of Jurassic Park, like a theatrical release extra. And we had a whole just wild miming conversation where I saw him and just started waving my hands and being like, you, the pin, me, also, the shirt, I love you.
We're best friends now for this, you know, half hour in the bar. Those moments are so good.
A really sweet drunk couple came up and told me about their relationship and how they'd met. It was so nice to go and be out in that space and just sort of drink it in. And I think I
no pun
need
intended.
Those. There was a little of that too. Don't judge me, it's Pride. And also they had this magic German beverage from the 90s. Anyway.
I want to know more about this German beverage. You're going to have to look it up.
I need to. I took a photo of it. Anyway.
I have one more thing to talk about that is not nearly as joy-filled.
Take it back.
So I'm gonna pull it back from the joy and human connection that I felt. So I recently, like 2 days ago, I watched the movie Annihilation, which is based on the first book in a trilogy by Jeff Vandermeer. I think it's just the Southern Reach trilogy. The first one's also called Annihilation. So I watched the movie. And everybody can kind of tell that I like to watch movies. I like to watch them in theaters. I like to watch them on the phone. I like, I'll watch them wherever. And so sometimes I go through phases where I will just sit down and watch a couple of movies or go see a couple because I feel like I haven't saturated myself. So I watched Wrinkle in Time, and then I watched Pacific Rim 2, which was not good. And then I watched Annihilation. And part of that was because I had just watched two movies that were just... Wrinkle in Time's good, but not amazing. And Pacific Rim 2 was a fucking shame upon its name. And Annihilation is just this stunningly well-crafted movie. Because it's a sort of sci-fi suspense horror movie about this scientist who... her husband was in the army and deployed to somewhere she didn't know where, and he had been missing for a year, and then he just shows up. Like, he shows up back at the house and he doesn't remember much. Like, he doesn't remember how he got there. He just seems odd. And then it turns out he's very, very sick, and she is with him at the hospital, and she's taken to this facility where she finds out that her husband had been on a special assignment to this area called Area X, which was a part of like the Florida swamplands that strange, inexplicable stuff was going down. And there was this strange shimmer creating a border around it. And this facility was sending people in teams to try and figure out what the fuck. And most of them, like none of them had come out except for her husband. And he had sort of mysteriously showed up, and now he's dying. And so this character is like, all right, I'm going to go into that fucking area. I'm going to find out what's going on. And let me tell y'all, it is stunningly beautiful, well acted. The main characters are all women. It's horrifying in so many ways because when they get in there, they lose the first 3 days that they're in there. They wake up and they're like, okay, according to our rations, we have already been here for 3 days. Nothing makes sense. They're starting to see a lot of copies of stuff. The foliage isn't looking natural. Like, there's just too much diversity among the same plant. And they're just like, what the fuck is going on in here? Nothing's right. And then they start to pick up on the fact that everybody who went in there before died and or killed each other in gross ways. It's real fucking unnerving. It's fucked up. And there was a scene, if y'all have seen Annihilation, I'm just gonna say the bear still haunts my goddamn dreams. One of the, I won't spoil what actually happens, but I will say there's a bear who murders somebody, and because of its essential like genetic mutation, it can mimic the sound of that person's death screams.
Oh no.
Yeah, that one got me pretty bad. So I watched the movie and I was fucked up by it. I was fucked up by its themes. I was fucked up by how well it was made. I was fucked up by the ending. I was fucked up by the bear. And I was, sort of sitting in it. And it's rare that I'm freaked out. I can be moved, but I'm not usually freaked out. And I was talking to our friend James, and they were like, have you read the book? And I said, no, I haven't. So I went and got the trilogy, and I'm on book two. And book one is quite different from the movie. Basically, the director and writer of the movie read the book once and then never reread it and wrote the script like, I want this to be like a fever dream version of what I read. I don't want it to be the same. I want it to be like my fucked up impressions of it. And it is. It's a very different story. But I was thinking about how important it is that sci-fi tells these stories that are so complex. Like, this is essentially a story about trying to solve the mystery of this bizarre area and whether or not like there's an extraterrestrial force or whatever. Like, that is the plot line. This woman is trying to solve a mystery. But in reality, the themes, the book deals with themes of ecology and changes in America and climate change and loss of identity and depersonalization. And the movie deals with some of that also, but there's huge themes of self-destruction and suicide and depression. And both are telling broader stories through sleight of hand, because we have this speculative framework to play in. Like, we don't have to do things head on. We can do them in the background. Like, we can use these incredibly heightened non-real world stakes to tell extremely personal and human stories about how we may unintentionally sabotage ourselves, our jobs, our relationships. And somebody, I saw a lot of people talking about how the movie Annihilation perfectly encapsulated what depression felt like for them, which was not an experience I had, but I understand it. And I am just so fucked up by this movie and the first book. I'm halfway through the second one. I had a moment where I was like, I haven't been shaken by a film and a book in quite this way for some time. I hadn't been as surprised, even though some of it, even the ending, I kind of saw coming. It didn't matter. It was still really effective. I encourage people who can deal with the themes that I discussed and also some scary stuff and horror to watch it, because it fucked me up real good.
It's so funny. Like, I'm generally fairly cowardly when it comes to movies, but everything you've said about it is like, yeah, now I kind of want to watch that.
It's really fucking good. And there's full women of color in the movie, like Tessa Thompson and Gina Rodriguez. And Gina Rodriguez is a queer woman in it. The thing that I loved about Area X in the book and in the movie is one of the reasons why it's so horrifying is because we can't really comprehend it. And the form that the sort of villain takes in the book, that's a ill-fitting description, but whatever, we'll go with it. It's vaguely Lovecraftian. Like, you can't look directly at it. You can't really fathom it. You can't wrap your mind around it. Like, we've reached the limitations of our ability to deal with and comprehend the thing. And there's something so well done about that in the book, and to a lesser degree about the movie. And the movie's explanation is basically that it's refracting everything, including on a cellular level. There's fucked up, at one point, buildings are being infested with foliage like a cancer. There's, you know, like I mentioned, the mutation of the bear, but there's also a mutated like shark alligator. There's just so much going on, and it's so good. I really like it. And the director is Alex Garland, who did Ex Machina and The Beach. And did he do Sunshine? I think Danny Boyle did Sunshine. Let's look it up.
I'm just really delighted because I looked at the book just now, and it's in the category of weird fiction.
The way that it's written
by that
is not naturalistic in any way, and yet it's so effective. I read a review of it where someone was like, halfway through this book, I had a panic attack, and not because of what was happening, just because of the mood. And I think that kind of explains, like, there's just this sense of wrongness through all of it, and yet it's intensely personal. And the main character in the book, who is not actually given a name, it's quite different, but all of the characters only know each other by their like titles and designations, in a part so that they are not so attached to the idea of their life outside of Area X. So when they go in, they're just there to do their job and possibly die there. The biologist speaks in a way, and the psychologist speaks in a way that is not, most people don't speak like that, even scientists. It was very formal. It was very Vulcan-ish. It just didn't sound like natural speech. And yet it worked so well, you almost didn't notice it. And that was not a situation that happened in the movie. Everyone was fairly naturalistic as much as they could be. It's such a strange novel. And I've seen people like it. I've seen people dislike it, but it fucked me up. Also, yes, I was right. He did Sunshine. He also did 28 Days Later. And he did fucking Dread. Oh, God. Alex Garland. Why? Oh, he was just the producer of Dread. And the script. Oh, Alex Garland. Shakes head. But yeah, I am now realizing how much I enjoy Alex Garland's films. I think he has a similar idea of the themes that I enjoy. Oh, it's just so good. I recommend that you watch it, Austin, but I also know that you're probably going to have to curl up under a blanket through parts of it.
Yeah.
It's conceptually fucking amazing. I haven't seen a sci-fi movie I've liked that much in a long time, and I see a lot of them. I asked Macy, I was like, Macy, have you seen... Oh, I didn't even assume she'd seen it. I was like, have you heard of Annihilation? And she was like, oh yeah, that was my jam. I really liked it. And I was like, wait, the movie or the book? She's like, both. I was like, what? You saw a movie and I didn't know about it?
Yeah, I've seen it recommended by a lot of people I know. It's just a very unique, very fucked up thing.
Yeah, and I still have a hangover from it. Like, obviously, I've got another book and a half to read, and they're quite different. The movie is the movie, and the first book is the first book. They're different entities. But I'm still just like, I'm not ready to leave the Southern Reach yet. For all of it, it's super fucked up. And there's also a theme of just because it's change doesn't mean that it's bad. Like, what it's doing to the environment and what it's doing to the people in it. And I don't want to spoil too much, but just because this thing is encroaching on our existing Earth doesn't mean that it needs to be stopped. What if it's better than what we have? So I'm really fucked up about that. And I like that there's just so many themes and so many symbols hanging out.
This has been a really weird episode of THR. I'm kind of into that as just sort of the encapsulation of weird project of ours that has changed so much from what it once was and is now about to spread its wings and fly off to heaven. While a new baby podcast is born.
The Red Pen. Remember when we started THR and it was us around Daria's Yeti at the dining room table?
We only had one mic.
No pop filter.
No pop filter.
And Daria had to sit there and listen to us and like make notes about every time we banged the table.
Now we just accept it as bitter inevitability.
Yeah, and we don't share a mic. That would be horrifying.
That too. That would be rough. It would have to be in two cities at once.
Well, my friend, are we getting close to wrapping up?
I think we are. I guess I just want to say thank you again to everybody who's been on this wild ride with us. And thank you for all of your suggestions over the years and engagement and conversation. Thanks to everybody who's come and talked to us at Read With Pride over the years.
Yeah.
And thank you to Read With Pride for introducing the two of us and for hosting us on panels and stuff through the years. It's just been such a wild, fun thing. And I'm so excited to keep doing it and to, you know, take all the lessons we've learned from this podcast forward, because we've learned so much. I feel like this is always the nature of that first
anything.
Project, you yeah. know, that first project you do, like the first scarf you knit, it, you know, it goes wild. Is that, that's not a reference other people get, is it?
I mean, I feel like they can extrapolate.
Yeah. Sometimes I forget that not everybody grew up knitting just sort of a lot. The first time you knit a scarf, your stitch gauge varies wildly, so it goes in and out and in and out and in and out, and then you drop a bunch of stitches and it partially unravels in a bunch of different spots. Anyway, that's our podcast. It has widened and narrowed and unraveled a lot.
We put it aside for 6 months and then came back to it.
Sometimes you just start doing a different stitch sort of in the middle, and then you're like, I don't want to go back and change this, so I guess I'll just keep doing it and pretend it was supposed to be like that.
No one will notice once the scarf is on. It's intentional. Yeah. I am so happy that y'all have stuck with us and that our audience has grown so much more than we ever would have dreamed. I remember when our first episode got like 40 listens, I was like, oh my god, 40 human beings.
I actually remember that. I was like, I was blown away. I was like, why?
I was like, who are they? I want them to, like, tell me who they are. It's so weird. It's weird. Why do so many people, why do thousands of people listen to us, though? Like, why?
But I'm so glad that you do. And I hope you've enjoyed this weird episode that we made. And I hope you enjoyed us getting up on our soapboxes and yelling at you today.
And I would like to reiterate, fuck William Shatner.
Is there anything else polarizing we can say before we leave this aside?
I'm looking at my walls like, speak to me.
You're looking around like, what else can I say to alienate some people? We've only got a few minutes left.
Infinity War is not a good movie.
I just decided not to watch Infinity War because it looked bad.
It's not well made. There's like things in it that are acceptable, but overwhelmingly. Also, I can't really decide how I feel about it until the sequel, which is a dumb thing. Overwatch
is a really good game. I think we just have to end the podcast now.
Yeah.
There's nowhere to go but down from here.
Oh, I have one last thing, aside from our Twitter outro. As of the airing of this episode, our Twitter and our Facebook for the Red Pen are up, so I will include those in the show notes. Our Twitter handle is Red Pen Pod. So go at us and wait for our updates. And if you're our patron, you'll get some updates as we sort of develop. We have our theme and everything.
There's nothing there to look at.
No, just our logo and our...
But,
that's it. Watch that space. I'm so excited for y'all to hear an episode and hear our theme and be with us on this journey. This magical, fantastic voyage. If you want to continue this conversation and say goodbye to the Hopeless Romantic, you can do that on Twitter. I am at Amanda H. Jean, and the H stands for Hollywood.
I am at AustinChanted. Ed is a pun that makes it enchanted.
It's cute. I'm glad you explained that, because what if someone didn't know and they just had an oh moment?
Yeah, there you go. It was sort of an interesting decision that I made long before it occurred to me that somebody else might come along and just take the name Austin Chant, and then I would never have that. But, you know, we all live and learn.
You gotta get that as a secondary and just camp on it.
Oh, that ship has sailed.
Someone has Austin Chant?
Yeah.
Shit! Imposter! Who are they? What do they do? Why? Your dark doppelganger?
Yep.
This is a sign.
It's an empty account with protected tweets. They do have 4 followers, though.
Maybe those 4 people think that person is you.
Actually, I think they've had the account longer than I have.
Oh, well, you're the imposter.
Maybe I'm the imposter.
You're the fake. You're the doppelganger.
Oh, man.
Dark.
Well, now that I've learned something unfortunate about myself, goodbye, everybody. Goodbye to THR, and thank you for coming with us, and we'll see you on the SS Red Pen.
And remember that I did it my way.
Wait, I want to go back.
What?
I feel like I didn't mean like the SS. Like...
Let's try
again. All aboard the what is it? Or the HMS, right?
Oh yeah, HMS. Yeah,
yeah,
HMS.
Yeah, yeah. I'll see you all aboard the HMS Red Pen as it sails from the harbor.
It won't sink
into podcast reality. It is not like the Titanic.
There's enough lifeboats. Bye.
This episode of The Hopeless Romantic was produced by Daria DeFora and Amanda Jean, with art by Keezy Young and music by Carly Ann Warden. If you want to continue the conversation, follow us on Twitter at TheHRPodcast, follow us on Facebook, check out our Patreon, and please rate and review on iTunes if you enjoyed.